Yeah, say that one more time.
Yeah, let's jump into Act 3. Let's go.
Let's go.
Shit is happening. Continuing to happen. I mean, that's always the case in this play. It's so economical. I think Bloom called it a brutal economy. I think it was Bloom talked about it as like his one of his like two particular favorite plays. This, and I believe Measure for Measure, which is not a great play, which is interesting. I mean, he also had a thing for like Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream, which is like, okay, that's like a okay character, but he's like, in his book on Shakespeare, he has like a 40-page, I don't think I'm exaggerating, like a 40-page musing on Bottom's dream, and it's like, okay? even his 40 pages of swooning about it aren't like terribly convincing. It's like, I don't know, man. I think you just maybe read the play as a 9-year-old or something and have a special affection for it. But I would say in this case, at least with Macbeth and the brutal economy of the play we're working with, Harold was right. What do you want to talk about scene one?
So Banquo is, it seems like, suspicious of Macbeth at this point.
Yeah, I think people are starting to cotton on.
Yeah, it's a pretty big change. You know, it's pretty sudden, but it makes sense, I guess. The previous...
Well, certainly for Banquo, I mean, he knows...
Yeah, but the previous scene we talked about was... or we have different divisions where the scenes are, but...
Right.
They're...
Previously, at least.
They're all in about... You know, yeah. The sons are guilty and Macbeth is innocent. So that's an innocent sudden change, I would say.
Well, yeah, I guess it takes time and, like, you know, going back to your room and being like, wait, what?
Yeah,
and then Macbeth just killed the only possible witnesses or confessors or whatever? Huh.
He says, and I fear thou playedest most foully for it.
Right.
And then he basically... declares his allegiance to them in person. Macbeth and Lady Macbeth come in.
Right. We have another moment of etiquette, of ceremony, to use Lady Macker's word for it. Which just, makes pretty blatant what I was saying before about how ceremony is, you know, the nice words of evil people or however you want to put it. It's the smiling face on the murderer who's going to assassinate you.
Yeah, it's pretty quickly juxtaposed to meeting with the murderer.
Yeah.
And
basically
Macbeth says, I can't wait to get your advice and you're going to be such a great member of my team. I guess Banquo has to go home for supper or something
forever.
Like that.
Well, he's just going to go riding.
For fun? I couldn't get that.
I thought so.
Yeah, I figured.
He and Fionce, because there would be a bit, I don't think they could ride back and... He just says, like, he's going to while away the hours until...
Okay, I see.
Yeah, I got a vibe that he was, like, trying to mull things over, maybe.
Right. Makes you wonder what would have happened. So, yeah, I guess in between meeting... In between Banquo and meeting the murderers, there's not much interesting... There's not many interesting lines...
Yeah, well, I will like underline the fact that I think we might have different scenes too here, because for me, I think meeting the murderers is scene two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mine's scene one. Yeah.
No, I'm wrong. That was scene one.
Okay.
But before the murderers come out, I do want to talk about a couple things that Macbeth in his, at least when he's alone on stage, says, to be thus is nothing. So it's like line 52, to be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus, our fears in Banquo stick deep, and in his royalty of nature reigns that which would be feared. 'Tis much he dares, and to that dauntless, I mean, he's like obviously projecting, and to that dauntless temper of his mind, he hath a wisdom that doth guide his valor to act in safety. So yeah, that word and that concept is going to ring back again and again through this, at least, I mean, yeah, through basically the remainder, safety and just being safe, safeness.
Right.
Just want to put that pin in there. And then I guess, yeah, just some lines to read at the end. If it be so, for banquets, like line 70, for Banquo's issue have I filed my mind. For them, the gracious Duncan have I murdered, put rancors in the vessel of my peace only for them, and mine eternal jewel given to the common enemy of man to make them kings, the seed of Banquo kings. Rather than so, come fate into the list, and champion me to the utterance. I just like those lines.
Yeah, sorry, I did forget about that soliloquy. That is,
yeah, that's an important soliloquy, I would say. Just kind of setting up the baron's scepter in my grip. So yeah, the fruitless crown. There's a lot of different ways that he talks about that. My genius is rebuked. But yeah, baron scepter and fruitless crown. Those are usually like. Or at least, I've seen in productions those lines taken out and made into like the posters for the productions.
Fate is an interesting word to use there. I wonder if it was a throwaway word or if it means more than...
Which word? Safe?
Fate. F-A-T-E.
Oh.
Just because,
yeah,
of
that's
the witches.
That's an interesting point that we'll get to, I guess, in scene 5 when we talk about Hecate,
okay,
or whatever scene that is for you.
Okay.
I have a weird theory about the workings of fate that, like, I think, well, yeah, we can just talk about it. I think that, like, a lot of people, when they read this play, especially, like, I don't know, in, like, 11th grade, it feels like a very 11th grade English assignment to say, like, was Macbeth, you know, fated to do this, or was it like his own, you know, ambition? And my feeling from the play, I mean, yeah, even like A.C. Bradley talks about this like way too much in his lectures on Macbeth, where it's like, you know, it just has to be like one or the other. I would say that I think the uncanniness of the play and the kind of or the uncanniness of the play, to me, a lot of it comes from the ambiguity and the, it almost like feels like the answer to that question, was Macbeth fated to do this, or was he just like seduced on his way that he was going to go to, or, you know, were the witches just decorative, which is basically, if I'm way oversimplifying A.C. Bradley's point, but basically what he says is that they were just like decorative. They were like fun Halloween spooky guys, lady guys. I don't know how you would, bearded ladies, who are, you know, just atmospheric. But I would say I feel like it just like it's ambiguous and it goes back and forth. Like when Macbeth is on the stage, it feels one way, I think. And then when he's not on the stage, and especially when the Weird Sisters are like talking amongst themselves, it feels another. Like, it feels like Macbeth is like, you know, master of his domain or whatever. When he's on the stage, like, it's, you know, his decision making, and it's his ambition that is seducing himself on. Maybe his wife's in there too a lot. But then, like, Hecate says some stuff that's like, he kind of seems to have foreknowledge, or at least was like spying on him or something, which I think does. I don't think that I would come down on the side either of the witches just like leading him on and him just being an empty vessel. I think it's kind of both. I feel like he's you know, fated the way he's going to go based on his ambition or so. I don't think Shakespeare was really probably that worried about having an answer to that in like just dramatic terms. And so I think it just like scene by scene, it changes whether or not it's like, and that might be a bad answer or whatever.
What do you think about, what do you think about his use of the word here against Banquo?
So yeah, let's get the, give me the specific lines. Give me a second.
Yeah, so you had read it, I think, but he's basically calling upon fate rather than Banquo have a line of kings. Come, fate, into the list and champion me to the utterance.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess there's like a good ambiguous use of fate there, like, you know, beckoning on fate. It doesn't, yeah. It's not clearly just, oh, I'm destined to have this happen. I have, you know, some kind of like Calvinist sense of damnation or salvation. Yeah, it's kind of contingent fate, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. And he's obviously acting to hire these murderers, and his manipulation of them is interesting. What's intriguing?
He is like a, I mean, this does remind you that they mentioned at some point that Malcolm had gone to specifically, I remember being vague on this before, but they specifically say that he goes to the English court of Edward. So that would be Edward the Confessor, which is like 1040 to 1060 or something. So, like, it is important to remember that these are, like, really dumb people. Like, this is like, especially dumb people. And especially murderous people, especially, like, brutal warrior people. Yeah, that's an important context, I think.
But the subtlety of the conversation between minor characters is, I think, a sign of what makes something great. You know what I mean? When you talk about the economy, but then you dig into these, you know, the other characters, like the other lords or whatever, talking between themselves, and then Macbeth talking to the murderers and so forth. There's a lot in
there. Yeah, it's like a comprehensive play. There's not, like, a lot of chaff. There's not a lot of fat.
But yeah, he manipulates them by I guess saying that Banquo was the reason that they had been captured previously, I presume, for their crimes and tortured.
Although it sounds like he was at fault.
I'm assuming yes, he was.
It wasn't
at fault.
Me, it was him.
Yeah, and they had believed it to be Macbeth previously. And then he basically questions their manhood if they're not going to get revenge on Banquo.
Yeah.
There's that interesting paragraph about men and dogs in the categories of what we call things.
Yeah. Yeah, what do you think about that first, I guess I'll say? Just like the disquisition, I guess, on breeding.
It's interesting. It sounds like an insult offhand. Sounds like an insult his mind goes there when the murderer says, "We are men, my liege," which what he means is we do want revenge, basically. We feel angry.
And we will kill people.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of imagery that has to do with just animals, beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels like it plays kind of in a weird place in my wondering about the, like, you know, the like Macbeth's fate versus Macbeth's, you know, independent action, where animals are like, you know, independent actors, but they're also just like instinctual beings. And putting people on that level of curs and whatever, all the dogs he names, or all the bears that he names that could haunt him and he wouldn't be scared or whatever. Or the leopards and scorpions. I guess it's not animals, but we get a lot of a preponderance, I would say, of like images of the natural world. Who by definition, things that by definition are, yeah, again, kind of wild, but like not, you know, completely untethered from instinct or whatever. And so one other thing I wanted to ask was, how do you feel about the fact, and this doesn't have to have a huge answer, I could see an answer that's just like about economy, but how do you feel about the fact that he, like, Macbeth talked to them yesterday, and we're like getting the second part of a conversation. We're not getting the part where he walks them through Banquo actually being guilty. He's just like reminding them or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Because like I could see, I mean, dramatically, wouldn't it be?
Is this the next day? Is this the next day after the murder? I would say.
I think it's been a couple days.
Okay.
Because yeah, he said that yesterday he had met with these murderers about murdering Banquo, basically.
Right.
So yeah, that would be a bit much, and he's already having banquets, you know. So that would be a bit quick, I think. And they're getting like news back from different places and messengers back. So yeah, I would say it's been a while since the murder. But yeah, what do you think the effect of having, again, this is like just like the circling back session with these murderers. It's not the original, hypothetically more dramatic scene. What do you think about that? The more dramatic scene where he actually convinces them.
Yeah, they had to come to the castle, or you know, it's easier, I guess, to have them come to the castle. Perhaps he met them at a tavern, or there would have been some kind of diversion to show the first part. I think it shows he is moving quickly, because if you recall before the murder, he wanted to speak with Banquo, and you know, there's an ambivalence about whether he meant to talk things through and be convinced against killing or not. But I think
or if he was just like making a show of.
Yeah, he could have been making a show, but I would presume he was sincere comrades with Banquo, and you know, in terms of having the same profession and relying upon each other for their lives. So I'm assuming they were friends. So it shows a consideration, like a premeditation, that's a quick change maybe, or like a sinister evolution in his...
before now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I guess that's what I was thinking too, where, the sense, our sense of time... having it like already be half done or more than half done, where he's convinced, he's just like reminding them of what they're supposed to do. It does kind of like unseat us in like, it's just like a weird suddenness, I guess. Whereas like having a normal linear scene where it's like, I have to talk to these murderers. I have to convince them. Let me go through, you know, step A, step B, step C of my argument. That would be like pretty linear and organic, but yeah, this kind of like unorganic, I don't know, like foreshortening of time.
But it keeps him at the palace. Interesting. It keeps him at the
and it keeps him at the palace. Yeah, that's. I mean,
he wouldn't might have to been leave, able I to guess.
Write around.
Yeah,
him having to leave. But yeah, that's another. At least that's another important element of the scene. That like, yeah, he's just like. They're just like not leaving. There's no sense of Shakespeare certainly by now had written plays like Henry IV Part One that have like this cinematic kind of scope where it's just like here's a place and here's a place and we're here and we're in Northumbria and we're in wherever. Here we have the effectiveness of like basically a haunted house, you know.
Exactly. I do think it's effective. I really prefer, I don't know what it is, but I do prefer plays and movies that have the setting as a character where you sit with it for most of the time. So that to me is effective.
House of the Seven Gables or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Another nuance to the killing or the hiring of the murderers, I mean, is he didn't tell his wife, which comes up soon.
Right. So she can be innocent. There's a little bit of a... Yeah. What do you think about that?
Again, it shows the ability to be a strong writer within a short frame, and it's like, it's crazy how many details there are to this play, which you could tear apart or look at. That's an interesting nuance there, because he kind of, I didn't take it like he was trying to keep her innocent. Maybe there's a divide there, or like he's becoming his own person or trying to, you know, maybe that's what's going on.
Yeah, let's kind of keep a pin in that for scene four, I guess, where that relationship kind of reaches its fork.
Well, it might be unraveling a little bit, you know, or that's showing an unraveling because initially he wrote her a letter, which started this whole thing off, basically. You know, he didn't have to do that. And without that letter, without the invitation, basically, to make the witch's prophecy come true, we wouldn't be here. And yeah, now he's not even telling her about what he's
doing. I would at least imagine that there's, like, maybe not, like, an open... I mean, because, I wouldn't say that there's, like, an open, I don't know, hostilities or open rebellion. But there is, like, a kind of, if not shame or guilt, at least, like, discomfort with the other people in your plan, halfway through the plan. Everyone's covered in blood. He talks about, like, wading through a sea of blood. So, at the very least, it's, you know, hard to flirt with a woman after you've done that. Maybe in, like, a Coen Brothers movie or something.
You think, you're talking about, oh, can you unpack that? Because I'm not sure what you mean by that.
I'm just saying that, like, I think that I don't know if I would say that there's, like, even, like, a open rift in their relationship so much as just, like, you're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to have, like, you look at the other people in your plan to murder people and they're covered in blood, you know?
Yeah, but then again, I mean, it seems like he vacillates between being committed to the situation because why not? Or she kind of obviously encourages that, but he has some of that in him when he's trying to kill Banquo. Mm-hmm. I mean, planning ahead. And then he kind of goes back and kind of back to that. Like, why don't I have peace in my life? Why I sent, you know, I sent Duncan to peace. I love that paragraph, which I'm looking at right now.
The peace that I would love to have.
Yeah. And, she's basically.
You want to read that paragraph?
Yeah, sure. Which I like the first line. I don't know what it means, but I can by you know, the context. But he says we have scotched the snake, not killed it, which means I guess he hurt it and didn't kill it.
I think there's an idea that you could, like, or maybe there are even some snakes that you can, like, cut in half, but they, like, grow back together or don't die.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
She'll
close
and
be herself whilst our poor malice remains in danger of her former tooth. That's such a good, you know, it's such strong writing. It's crazy. But let the frame of things disjoint. Both the worlds suffer ere we will eat our meal in fear and sleep in the affliction of these terrible dreams, which is another detail to come out of
it. Got a lot of nightmares.
That shake us nightly. Better be with the dead, whom we, to gain our place, have sent to peace, than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. That would be a good title for a Shakespeare book. Restless ecstasy. Duncan is in his grave. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. Treason has done his worst, nor steel, nor poison. Malice, domestic, foreign levy, nothing can touch him further. Foreign levy was funny. And then there's a line a little bit later on. Where does she say? Where she basically says, things that can't be changed, you shouldn't even think about it. She might have said it before. But I like that line.
Not had all spent where our desires are. Tis safer to be that which we destroy than by destruction. I mean, there's that word safer again when Lady Macker says, not had all spent where our desires got without content. Tis safer to be that which we destroy than by destruction dwell in doubtful joy.
Yeah, right.
Man, I love that line.
And then she keeps going, and that she says it right before that speech I just read. Things without all remedy should be without regard. What's done is done.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that a lot in my life. I think I say that a lot, you know?
Okay, Lady Mackers, let's see how you keep up with that.
Right.
See how you do with that.
Yeah, but it's like he kind of had that point of view about Banquo, and it's weird to see such quick shifts in emotion, or not weird. It's normal. It would be normal, I think, to go between fits of like desperation and anger, or whatever he's going through in this situation.
Intersecting sine waves.
Yeah, but right before this, he was pretty, he was pretty calm and collected about murdering his best friend. You know, so
yeah.
Banquo, thy soul's flight, if it find heaven, must find it out tonight.
Well, yeah, let's see. You want to go to Act 3, or Scene 3, or for me, Scene 3. I guess for you, Scene 2?
Yeah, where are you
assuming? So for me, it's Scene 3, where the murderers come back and murder
Banquo. That's
Scene
3 for me. Yeah, Scene 3 for me.
Okay. Is there anything interesting about that, other than that he gets murdered,
third
but
murderer
Cleon
joins for some reason?
What?
A third one joins them? That was weird.
Yeah, that's like a weird multiplication, isn't that? Like Macbeth is just like overdoing it, maybe.
And they
failed
to kill the son, you know?
I mean, maybe even failed because they had so many people.
Right.
Because one thing they say is that like the light had got, so like maybe, you know, depending on how you want to do it. I think this is probably how I would set it up, how I would choreograph it through the fight choreography, that like, yeah, the three people, like the three murderers come in and in stabbing Banquo, smash over the light, and thus like the overcrowded killing field is what does them in. I think that would be an effective way to do that.
Do you mean that there's not, like, if it was one person, you wouldn't have to coordinate the light. So it's kind of like, why do you need someone?
Well, yeah, so I think part of the reason Fleance gets away is because they just, like, can't see him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what I'm saying is that, like, the three people rush in and they're, like, you know, in the process of, like, you're just going after Banquo. Whoever is, you know, carrying the torch, that gets, like, snuffed out or knocked over by one of them. Where if they had just gone, like, two in and both, you know, kind of more cleanly just gone in and each one stabs one of them or something.
Yeah.
When you said
earlier dumb people, I initially thought you meant the murderers, but I think you meant the society of people. But the murderers seem pretty dumb too.
Murderers are very dumb.
Yeah. They're unusually dumb.
Yeah. But yeah, there you go again with, you know, is it fate or is it Macbeth's actions? And in this case, it feels like, especially if we're setting up our choreography where it's the three people kind of fucking up because there's three of them, that would be not that the witches got away because, or I mean, not, sorry, not that Fleance got away because the witches came in and intervened, Hecate came in and fucked some shit up. It's because Macbeth's own actions.
Well, I think when you're talking about the elements of the story that work, that are supernatural, wouldn't you think, I think to fables and myths and the Bible and things like that, that are kind of aspects of stories that work just because of, I think, how the world is, you know what I mean? It's sort of an aspect of the story that adds a lot because of, I think, our humanity and our need for that aspect of stories. You know, we like that. It adds something that I think a good story needs, you know, like something that comes out of the blue that you can't control, that explains things, you know what I mean? And then you have questions about what's going on because the conflicting desire to have a will to act versus something else controlling things, you know? And so that's an obvious statement, but
I mean,
totally
speaking of the Coen brothers, they love that. They love the, you know, random thing that just like intrudes in the story.
Yeah, because the prophecy is coming true and he's involved in it. And it's like, maybe if he had been chill, you know, he could have poisoned them at the dinner. You know, he's like, you know what I mean? He's kind of like overstepping himself, stepping over himself, whatever that's called.
Yeah.
For no reason.
Overdoing it.
Yeah. So that's
crossing
that's
his
a short
teeth.
Scene.
And then, Act 3, Scene 4. I wrote a paper about this a long time ago. It was only English 225, so it was like just like a take a scene and write about it. I forgot how short it was. I expected, like, how did I write a paper on a 200 line? I wrote like a 10-page paper on this. Yeah, I think the main theme of my paper was like about Lady Macbeth kind of losing her like last shreds of control, because after this, we never see her be sane again, awake or sane. So yeah, I guess that was the main focus of the paper. But yeah, this is, again, going back to the economy thing, it's like 160 lines for me or something. I don't know how yours is set up, but yeah, it's 175 lines, which is a couple minutes.
I feel dumb because I'm sure it was answered.
Or 8 minutes total.
I'm sure it was answered in something Lady Macbeth said, I think, to Banquo when he was going to go writing. But why are they having the banquet? Was there a reason besides the
Well, they're fraternity? The king, so they are doing that.
Okay.
I don't think there needs to be too much of a reason.
I agree with that.
Oh, reason, not the need.
I agree that there doesn't need to be
banqueters one. Are in the least banquet superfluous.
But it's set up where it's like they're mad Banquo is not there, and I mean this whole contrivance of like Fleance killed his dad, whatever the names of the sons are, killed the king, Duncan. And I think he's trying to set it up like Banquo's not, like he's a traitor or something, or he's not showing up and he should be showing up. I just dynamics of the banquet is interesting.
I would say it's at least like 50-50, like him trying to, you know, play it cool. Like, I don't know where this guy is, but also like, I'm thinking about this guy a lot because I just had him murdered.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, Macbeth is also dealing with losing his grasp on things also. Yeah, we have fits going on here. Yeah, what do you want to talk about?
Okay, I don't mean to linger on this. It's just that, like, is the banquet a normal, like, do you think this is a normal banquet, or do you think it's sort
of... It would have been normal.
Okay, because aren't they in a situation where this is kind of, this isn't really the time to have a banquet? You know what I mean? I don't know if that's probably over, I know it's a...
I think it's been a while since the death of Duncan.
Okay, that's, all right.
Yeah, for us, it's been like, you know...
A second.
25 minutes, yeah, stage time. But I think that would be like 10 to 15 days of reality.
Interesting, all right. Yeah, that's an interesting point about playing it down where I'm slowing it, or whatever the word is, expanding it out where the scenes are spread out. Days apart.
Yeah, and then Act 3 is all a day, you know, like everything that's happened that we've talked about so far in the last whatever many minutes, all of this is just one day. Mm-hmm. So that gets back to what I was saying before about like the like not it's not like a purely linear like balanced, like, you know, here's this act is this many days, and it's not like, you know, a couple of days of every month or something, like a season of Mad Men would be. It's like, yeah, it bunches. Time is like bunching and unbunching and going, like, you're going really quickly. We're just like gloss over a week and a half, and then we have, you know, 25 minutes on the stage or just one day, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
that's just like, important effect of the play.
The murderer comes in. They basically have important people over, like the lords and maybe ladies.
All the Scottish people. Lennox, Ross.
Okay, Lady Macbeth, Ross, Lennox, lords, and attendants. And they're the guests, and they invite them to have a great time, you know, and drink and eat. And then the murderer kind of comes to the door and interrupts the party.
Covered in blood.
Covered in blood. Yeah, it's this scene is interesting because of how many times we go between Macbeth talking to us or Lady Macbeth or the murderer and then addressing the crowd. And you wonder what they can see, you know what I mean? But I'm presuming they can't obviously, I'm assuming they can't see the killer talking to Macbeth.
Well, at least not his blood. They might, you know that there's an attendant.
Yeah, they'll see that he goes to the door, I guess, and they're probably like, oh, interesting, you know, he can't sit down and hang out with us or whatever. And he learns that Banquo was killed with 20 gashes on his head. It's pretty intense. And then that Fleance, the son, got away.
Yeah, which goes back to what we were saying about overkill.
Yeah. And that explains...
Overkill, ruinous overkill.
That explains in part why the ghost is so scary looking, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then comes my shit again. I had else been perfect. I had to flip pages. Whole as the marble, founded as the rock, as broad and general as the casing air. But now I am cabined, cribbed, confined, bound in to saucy doubts and fears.
Saucy.
But Banquo's safe. So hence why I put that tin in earlier, safe. The equivocation
a question mark.
On the word safety. Right. Yeah, is he safe? Yes, he's safe in the ground or whatever. Right. What is the exact? I put the book down for a second.
Safe in a ditch.
Yeah. I mean, he's more safe than you. That just like rings back that idea of Duncan lying in peace. You know, he is more safe than you are.
Right.
You'll only have safety when you're in the grave, which is, something that Macbeth is fighting, a reality of just life that Macbeth is fighting uselessly against. And people who fight uselessly against the inevitability of death are the people who, this is like a Freudian idea that you become the thing you fight. He becomes this specter of death trying to fight for his own eternal life, basically.
Right.
Eternal life and, you know, the immortality. I mean, this is a big idea in Shakespeare in the early sonnets, the idea that giving birth to people grants you a kind of more immortality.
Mm-hmm.
He has this, you know, fruitless crown, this barren scepter or whatever. He's not non-fructive, not going to have any heirs or whatever. His mortality, which he could, you know, just vibe with, you know. His fight against death is the thing that ensures that his life is just this living death. He's surrounded by death images, and his brain is full of scorpions, and he can't sleep for nightmares.
Yeah.
He has to kill his friend, and then he has to kill their sons, and then he has to kill babies and shit. It's what happens.
That's what happens.
Fear of death. the fear of death is just something you got to vibe with, not, you know, it's like write poetry or whatever, dude, you know?
Well, he's self-aware about it, and, he's not afraid of death like a coward, which we've talked about before.
Mm.
But,
yeah, that's an important addition there. That while he's not, he's has this bravery about like physical threats to himself. Yeah, he is very much affected by his non-immortality.
Right, he's,
I guess his mortality, you might say.
He got what he wanted, and it's not worth it, and he knows that. And to keep it, it's like he's
doubtless their doubtful joy. Yeah.
He's got to do all this nonsense. How do you feel about the ghost here? I can see you having a contrarian point of view or something.
What is the question about the ghost?
You're probably I'm seeing it plausible that you would say it's a gimmick and you don't like it.
I don't have an opinion on the ghost as like a dramatic effect.
I just wanted to see what you would say.
it definitely like feels right for the play at least.
You know, it's got to be hard to do well though.
It would be hard to do well, especially you know given the limited. We probably overestimate how bare the stage was in Elizabethan times.
Now, in Hamlet, isn't the ghost under the stage? Do I remember that correctly?
Well, it depends. He's like, it depends on your choreography.
Okay.
He like comes out above the bed or whatever.
So you do see it? You do see the ghost?
Well, yeah. The stage, if I remember correctly, the stage directions kind of leave it open. But yeah, he should be on the stage. I think I remember Baker talking about how like they would have him come out from under the stage because he's coming up from hell.
I guess I feel like it's a risk to do it with an actor sitting in the chair, and I think it would be always enjoyable and powerful if you could hear the voice, or I guess there's no words. So what am I talking about?
He doesn't say anything. Right.
Well, maybe it'd be powerful still if there's nothing in the chair, I guess. I feel like that's a safer route to go, but what do you think?
Yeah, that could work. I'm not sure how we would stage it. Some of it would depend on how quickly you could do like good enough makeup. It could be really powerful to just have it all be in Macbeth's head as far as we can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like in the position of Lennox or Ross or just somebody watching.
Well, what would you do about the dagger? Earlier when he sees the dagger, how would you handle that?
I guess that would be, I mean, if you're not going to have one, you're not going to have the other. And it's just, they're all in his mind.
Yeah. But if you have the ghost, would you have the dagger?
Yeah. Okay. I would do both.
I agree.
I don't know how, because you...
I think you got to make it extremely hideous and scary if you're going to do it.
20 gashes or whatever, yeah. which is why I wonder about just, like, the timing. Just, like, the physical timing. Maybe you can delay between scenes a little bit.
Because surely they didn't do that back then. Surely they didn't have a mask on the guy. I mean, I have no idea, but...
Well, I think, so we know that they presented this for King James himself during like the winter, every winter they would have like a bunch of plays put on. And, there was like a famous production of this for King James where they put the mirror up to him when they talk about Banquo's heirs, because he's one of Banquo's heirs, hypothetically, according to, I don't know if that's history or myth. But he draws his lineage from Banquo, either formally or informally. So that production where they're like inside in one of the wings of the palace or whatever, you've got Inigo Jones setting things up. I think there you might have more of a chance of putting powder on somebody's face or something. Whereas, for the general, like, day-to-day stage, yeah, that was hypothetically pretty bare. But then, you know, they did try to, like, use fireworks sometimes. Like, they burned down one of the theaters because they were using fireworks. So they weren't, like, averse to having any kind of stage effects.
Right.
But the fireworks thing, that was in the indoor theater that they built a little bit later.
And
so yeah, I think that like there probably was a little bit of a distinction between what they were able to do inside and outside, and just like the size of the audience and the placement where they were performing.
Yeah. Plus words, this is an elementary point, they would have had more of an effect, I think, on the audience than now because of our obsession with screens and images. So, you know, like,
yeah.
imagining, they're used to imagining, I guess is what I'm saying, you know.
Yeah.
More than us.
That is true.
So.
Lady Macbeth is trying to, like, keep him coming back to the table, keep him sane, trying to cover for him. How much of that do you want to talk about?
That's pretty much all there is to say, I guess, but...
Yeah.
She kind of, you know, she's in a bad spot because everybody's kind of watching him rave about this thing they can't see, and she's basically trying, and he reiterates it. Oh, this is normal. This is just like what he does all the time. Don't ask him any questions.
And it kind of echoes the Mark Antony Caesar thing from before. They don't make a clear reference to that. I guess I would skip to the end in that case. So like line 150 for me, like 153, which I think we mentioned before, where Macbeth says, "It will have blood." They say, "Blood will have blood. Stones have been known to move and trees to speak. Augurs and understood relations have by magpies and caught and chows and rooks brought forth the secret man of blood." What is the night? Maybe I'm repeating us from earlier, but yeah, that is kind of a reference to the somewhere in the Gospels where they talk about how the trees will speak sermons about God and the rocks will sing hymns to God. I forget exactly the reference, but do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do recall you mentioning that. It's kind of like the rocks will cry out if people don't praise God. I think is
right. What you're talking about. That which was referenced in As You Like It separately, because there are poems covered in, or there are trees covered in poetry in that case. But yeah, that's I feel like maybe a modern audience would have more trouble with realizing the uncanny effect of flipping that Bible idea around.
This is a weird conversation. I mean, it's one of the strangest back and forth in the play, at least for me, reading it. The way they're talking.
You mean the end between him and Lady Macbeth?
Yeah, and they kind of mention that when she's like, "You need some sleep here. You're kind of talking crazy.
You lack the season of all nature's sleep." She's like, "Yeah, I know. I am murdering people, so I'm having nightmares. I am in blood stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go over. Strange things I have in head that will to hand, which must be acted ere they may be scanned." Just have to keep going. Just can't even think about it. Just gotta go.
I remembered that murdering line about wading into the and then you think about the blood. Well, he says blood. I am in blood steeped. Yeah. You think about her line about the sea incarnate, or was that him, Incarnadine?
Yeah, I think that was him.
So they're a bit rattled. They've rattled the lords. It was a bad idea to do this banquet. Really bad idea.
We see pretty quickly one of the attendees is like, "Okay, so what are we going to do about the fact that Macbeth is murdering people?
Where is that? Hold on.
What do you think about that?" In scene six, after Hecate.
I got you.
Yeah. We get some sarcasm from Lennox, whoever the fuck that is. There are some sides of the play, because there's like, you know, we don't spend too much time with any of these side characters. It's like, wait, who is this?
Right.
Lennox? Anything else about scene four?
No. So, okay. Explain to me who Hecate is.
Hecate is like a... Well, I have a note somewhere. Let me look it up.
I honestly forgot to look that up. That was one of my intentions, but I forgot. I'm assuming it's a goddess or something of witches.
So it was like a goddess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Hecate is from Greek. It's like the goddess of witchcraft and...
Okay.
Crossroads and
that's pretty
places.
Obvious. Yeah. She's like the leader of the witches. She comes down and
how dare you not have involved me?
Yeah, and she's gonna help him out, but that's all they talk. That's all that happens. She's gonna come back.
Yeah,
she's going to the moon. Okay, she'll be back.
And there's like ill portents. There's clouds of evil up at the moon that she has to bring back. And yeah, everything I wanted to talk about this scene, I already talked about because I got ahead of myself. All that stuff about like destiny versus
true. But
making your own destiny or whatever.
In terms of experiencing the play, I think it's good to bring him back more than once, mm-hmm. you know, because you're reminded about that element of the play. And I'm assuming there's thunder and lightning or something and dark clothing. And so it kind of breaks up the monotony of the lords and all that real quick and then takes you over to Linux afterwards. So I think it's a good interjection there.
Yeah. And then scene six. I don't really have anything to say about scene six. That's just like, you know, that's an important point where Lennox is being sarcastic and other lords are seeming to align against Macbeth.
So Lennox is conniving against Macbeth is what you're saying? Because they talk about the politics. Yeah,
he's getting sarcastic. He's like, oh, wow, yeah, all these guys keep that. Huh, man, yeah.
Mm. Mm, okay. Yeah, that's good to know because I...
visits Macbeth's castle is dying. That's crazy.
Well, just like that...
And it all gets pinned conveniently on brothers. And wasn't it great? I mean, the line that I guess sells the sarcasm to me was like, when Lennox was like, wasn't it great that Macbeth was there to kill all the witnesses?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, like, line 12, damned fact how it did grieve Macbeth. Did he not straight in pious rage the two delinquents tear that were the slaves of drink and thralls of sleep? Was not that nobly done? Aye, and wisely too, for 'twould have angered any heart alive to hear that men deny it.
Yeah,
glad we didn't have to hear them denying that murder they didn't commit. Yeah.
All right, I plead that I did not read that as sarcasm initially. You know, when in scene two or whatever it is for you in act two, when Ross and the old man talk, I had trouble with that too. And Macduff, and it's kind of like it's just not normal conversation, you know. Not that we're used to it. It comes off, the politics and stuff come off as dry to me, like almost like a necessary evil to the play's detail.
You almost have to, this is just like a general thing about this play. I think you almost have to assume everything is double talk, is double speak.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is equivocation, so you know, should have have a kind of readerly paranoia about anything. okay. That's the best way to assume that people aren't, it's best to assume that people aren't just saying their heartfelt, earnest, you know, unless it's like Lady Macbeth and Macbeth in a room locked with no one else in there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people are bullshitting and people are, oh, I will miss you so much until I get to see you as I send my murderers out to kill you. You know, it's all it reminds me and sarcasm.
It reminds me of our book we read with in college. And what was that?
Renaissance self-fashioning?
Yeah, but what was that phrase we always repeated? It was like,
fiction known to be fiction?
Yeah, so these people are working within the context of a court. So they are going to have that, I'm sure, be a part of everything they do because they got to watch their back. So that's an interesting thing to bring up because they're basically these two people, Lennox and who else?
The Lord. For me, it's an unnamed Lord. Yeah, another Lord.
Yeah, that's the same thing. So they're kind of like talking about something very serious if you think about it. It's basically what is the state of our court here because Maddox went to England with the
but
son.
With plausible deniability too,
right? I see what you're saying. It's kind of double talk about, we're kind of going to figure out what side we're on, basically. And let's see how this plays out because it
sarcasm
seems
is a kind of equivocation, to go back to the witches, even. Their equivocating talk, it's a sort of equivocation as much as the ceremony was, you know, the etiquette between these people. Everything they say is, you have to assume that it's meaning something the opposite of what it's meaning, or some tricky, tricksy little thing that they're actually correct, but not like not how you would expect them to be correct. Stuff like that.
Right. Well, we did good on the hour. We've been going about 55 minutes, so.
Oh, nice. I checked like 5 or 6 minutes ago, and I was like, okay, I think we can get through.
I figured that was going to be much longer than the previous one, but it wasn't, so.
I mean, it's kind of like all folding back in together, you know? It doesn't really, there aren't loose threads. This play has like such a kind of internal magnetism.
Yeah.
But it doesn't like sprawl out in the same way that like a King Lear definitely like sprawls out. Which is interesting because they were like the same year, 1606-ish.
Oh, wow. Well, I think crazy. Having the setting be very much, at least to this point,
it's very confined, local.
You think about, I'm like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I wonder what Lady Macbeth is doing right now. I wonder where she's at, you know? I think when you travel around all the time, it's different in how you're thinking about the
characters. It's like the, who did the 70s murder on the Orient Express?
Oh, Poirot?
Not the recent like
the '70s.
Yeah, like maybe Sidney Lumet.
I think
he did. Anyways, there's like there's a really good version in the '70s.
I know what you're talking about.
There's not a great version that was redone recently, where like all the shots, all the cameras are moving within the physical space of the
train
car. Whereas there was a recently done. It's like there's a lot of outside shots, which kind of break the kind of claustrophobia.
I can't remember that guy's name, but the guy doing Perot now is a tragedy. I can't stand
Kenneth Branagh.
Ugh. Yeah, he's wrong for that. I saw one of those. I didn't see the one with the train. I saw the Egypt one. And it was possibly, I mean, it's up there. It's got to be top 10.
I mean, some of it's just context where, like, I don't know if you could make the same kind of movies.
You got to commit to the era. It's like when you do Sherlock Holmes, you got to commit to the time period. And, like, that's my opinion.
Well, you also have to commit to it being, like, a mystery, you know?
Yeah, it was just shitty. It was horrible. And I'm sure the Orient Express one was horrible, too.
I haven't seen the whole Orient Express, but I have seen scenes where it's like, why are they doing that?
Yeah, you're totally right. And that was one of the genres of movies, really, the train movies back in the day. And they're great. And it's the same reason I love movies that, like a haunted house mystery movie. I mean, it's just, for some reason, going to a place and being confined there is, it definitely titillates you. It makes your mind think more about, like, where are the other people? What are they doing? You know, it just involves
yeah,
you more.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at, where it's like, yeah, if everybody's, like, sprawled out over, you know, like different countries, it's harder to think about, like, wait, who's in the library right now?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. All righty. Well, next we will do Act 4, so I'm game to do that anytime.
Okay, I'll let you know when I'm good.